The Florida community of mindfulness is happy to make these talks available to you. If you find this talk to be a benefit, please consider making a donation to support us. You'll find a donation button on the talks section of our website, floridamindfulness.org. Thank you, and may you be happy and free of suffering.
So this is the third day of this four-day retreat here in the Franciscan Center in Tampa, entitled Stabilizing the Restless Mind, Practicing Mindfulness and Calm Abiding, as we are now well into day three. And as we said this morning, hopefully everyone here has a deeper and better understanding about these practices of samatha that we have been practicing quite diligently and consistently over these past days, and also from the talks and the discussions, a better sense of how to create an environment for a stable, restless mind, and also to how to have the mind state that supports the practice. We did spend time on one day going into things like laziness and the various kinds of laziness and the lack of enthusiasm or interest, both in the practice or in our own transformation. We talked about the need for the mind to really understand, what the practices of samatha are and how they can bring you benefit. So it's very clear that you understand why you're doing it, and that these all these things that underlie a kind of a rational, lucid understanding of the practice that contributes to enthusiastic perseverance, joyful effort, is something that we understand that we have to continually cultivate. It is not just a one-time affair, not just a one-time-a-day affair. The mind has to be continually prompted to remember, smriti, to remember, not forget what we're trying to do with our life, until it becomes second nature. When will it become second nature? Well, you'll find that out one day. When you find that that has become, it doesn't take so much effort. You know, in the beginning, when you're training the horse or training the puppy, it takes a lot of effort to get them to comply. But if you're a persistent, consistent trainer of the puppy and of the horse over time, it'll become a lot easier. And hopefully you'll reach a time where you really enjoy each other. And there's a responsiveness between yourself and your mind. In the same way we get to enjoy, well, I've never enjoyed a horse, but I would imagine cowboys and cowgirls enjoy their horses. But we can enjoy our dogs. But there are people, you know, who didn't, for whatever reason, bother to train their puppy when it was young, and now their puppy is a grown dog. And if you're often around these people, they have problems. Maybe some of you have been there. It's not often an enjoyable experience to have a grown dog that still has a puppy mind. And many of us, unfortunately, are like that. We are adults carrying on our adult life, but we still have a mind that is, in a certain sense, not in the best sense, but sort of in the worst sense, of a childlike mind. And so the path we are following is a path, I would say, of maturity. We call it spiritual maturity, but I really think that's an add-on. I think it's really about just, becoming a mature human being. We have grown up. We are adults. And we have put away the childlike ways of thinking and behaving and acting that we did unconsciously as children. And now we're able to live a life that is stable and clear and mature, with goals and aspirations and values that are indicative of someone who has come into their understanding of what it means to be a human being, and certainly what it means to be an adult, and especially for those of us who have entered the Buddhist tradition, the river, this river of awakened experience, we certainly have such a clear template, such a carefully constructed paradigm to allow us to really enter the full maturity of what it means to be a human being in this life. And for that, we should be happy, you know, that we now have this path set forth so clearly to us. I did want to just revisit momentarily. I think I might have said this on the first night. Do you remember I said we're going to be working on samatha and calm abiding during this retreat, but I sort of wanted us to kind of practice sort of three kind of generic trainings. The first one, you remember, was to stay within the boundaries of the present moment and to really set up clear lines of demarcation within our minds to past and future, and to kind of keep those lines clear. Again, how do we keep them clear? By remembering. We have to remember. Remembering is the opposite of forgetting. For those of you who forget a lot, you need to put more emphasis on remembering. Okay. Remembering is the positive of not forgetting. So many people kind of get frustrated with themselves for forgetting, but they never practice remembering. So can you see why it doesn't work? I mean, it's like, oh, I need to be working on remembering what I'm supposed to be doing, remembering what my intention is, remembering what my aspiration is, and then I won't be forgetting as much. So we have to put the emphasis always on the learning of new skills, right? In the same way, endlessly working on our problems, endlessly working on our afflictions, without ever really putting most of our energy in cultivating the wholesome and the good and the healthy, again, will not produce much benefit for us, right? So this is the same thing. So first rule, I'm just restating it again, so in case anybody forgot and found themselves ruminating or daydreaming or about the past positively or negatively, or fantasizing, anticipating the future, any of that, please, on this last day of retreat, and again, now we are on our last day because, by around this time tomorrow, we'll be within a few hours of coming to an end. So if you haven't practiced the boundaries, now that you've been practicing meditation now for 2 or 3 days, your mind is probably much sharper and stronger, and you'll be able to do it more easily. So that was number one. Number two, remember, was no resistance to whatever is happening, right? Just to go along with the schedule, go along with what's going on, go along with the weather, go along with the room, go along with the AC, non-AC, go along with the food, go along with whether it's there or not there, Just as we said yesterday, and actually I remember I mentioned it with Shantideva, and I went to find the quote. I think it's translated in different ways, but here it's when somebody was saying, oh, that sounds like the Serenity Prayer. So the line 9 says, and this is on the chapter on patience, he says, so come what may, I'll not upset my cheerful happiness of mind. Dejection never brings me what I want. My virtue will be warped and marred by it. And then he says, if there is a remedy when trouble strikes, what reason is there for dejection? Really quite wonderful. whatever trouble is, quotes around trouble. Usually trouble is just something unwanted that happens to us. We call it trouble. If there's a remedy for it, then why be dejected? Right? Why be upset? There's a remedy. Be happy. There's something that can be done. And he says, if there's no help for it, what use is there being glum? Is that right, Sergio? So again, you know, we have to learn to appraise reality clearly with right thinking, right? And that's going on all the time in our life. You know, outside us and inside us. Whatever is arising, if there's a remedy for it, if it's something that's afflictive, then be happy there's a remedy and do it. You should be happy. Don't focus on the problem. Be happy there's a remedy. And if you know there's no remedy, and often in life there is no remedy or no quick remedy, and this is something, again, comes from your ability to look clearly at the situation with understanding of cause and conditions and go, yeah, in this moment there really no remedy. This is the way things have come together, and right now there's no help for it. If that's the case, then why be downcast? Why be glum? Why be depressed? It is the way it is, because of causes and conditions. It's a statement of fact. And so, anyhow. So that's, that's that. Now, so we don't want to resist anything that happens in life. I asked you to practice that during retreat. I mean, we have, I mean, the problems or the difficulties that we may have had to deal with in retreat are minuscule. All right. I mean, I'm just, you know, to compare to what some of us face in life and, of course, to what many of our brothers and sisters in this world are having to deal with. And so, you know, having said that, it's important that we go, gee, if I can't handle this, you know, if I can't handle the oatmeal not being there on time, you know, I mean, you know, how am I going to deal with the big issues in life? You know, the big problems, the big disappointments. So in that sense, we are aware that resistance to life, resistance to what's happening, is a mindset. And it's something I need to abandon, to embrace life. And many people get concerned there, but, oh, aren't there a lot of bad stuff in life? To embrace it doesn't mean you support it. It means you acknowledge that it's reality. You embrace the reality of what is. If there's a remedy for it, be happy. Oh, the cook's aware of it, and oatmeal is coming. Right? If there's no remedy for it, they're out of oatmeal, what? Have cereal. Yeah, have something else. You know, have some bread. It may not be what you wanted to have. You see, it may not be what we wanted to have, thought we deserved. See, we're very entitled. I mean, why did Brian get the last bowl of oatmeal? And here I am. There's nothing, you know. You know, we can just go off rather than just, you know, accept. And the worst comes to worst is what? You know, we have a smaller breakfast this morning. I mean, none of us are going to starve. And there are so many people in this world who this is their every day. So, I mean, it's, you know, we say in the meal chance, you know, to become aware that even in our eating, the whole world is present, right? And so it's important that we, again, these little things, you know, we're often just focused on the big things, but it's often our real character is demonstrated in how we handle the little things. That often shows us how we're going to handle the big things. So this, you know, just non-resisting to life and accepting all that's happening. And the third thing is this, this awareness that everything is fine in the moment. So Thich Nhat Hanh has a wonderful teaching where he says, you know, we have, each of us, in the moment, have everything we need to be happy. Very powerful. Right? Most of us think, no, I can't be happy now. I can't be peaceful now. Look what's going on in the world. Look what's going on in my life. Right? Can you see that's, we set up this standard that we can't be happy because, and the because are all the externals. But the truth is, and you learn this in meditation, and hopefully many of you, some of you have learned this, touched this in your practice of concentration and mindfulness, that no matter what's going on around us, we have the possibility in the present moment, whatever we're doing, to be present, to be calm, to be grateful, to be appreciative, right? And those are positive emotions. They feel good. They are wholesome. And so to realize that no matter what's going on, you have that freedom to be happy, freedom to be liberated from suffering, not at some future point, when you come to full awakening or half awakening or two-thirds awakening or, you know, quarter awakening. I don't know what your standard is. But right now, see, that's very empowering, isn't it? And many of us were scared of that. You know, many of us come from, this other mind state, which is all about, you know, what's wrong, what's lacking, what's missing, what's needed. And when I get all these things, then what? Then I'll be happy. I mean, that's called fantasy. Right? That's called future thinking. Right? If you want to be free, do your best to be free now. If you want to have a calm mind, do your best to have a calm mind now. Right? But you know all that. Forgive me for belaboring it. So those were the 3 points. Stay in the present. Keep those boundaries to past and future. No resistance to what's unfolding. And learn to even say yourself, everything is fine. Even with all that's going on in my life. Right? All that's going on in my family's life. All that's going on in the world. Right? Right? Even with global warming. Even with the end of time, even with the end of the planet, even with, politics continuing and getting worse. Right? Which all could happen, couldn't it? Yeah. Each of us have the capacity of, within our own mind, generating wholesome mind states. And that, in this world, is necessary, not just for me, but for all those around us. Right? If we generate the same amount of afflictive mind states, angry mind states, scared mind states, you know, depressed mind states, despairing mind states, there's so many others, of what benefit are we to them? Right? Of what benefit are we to them? So, this is a very simple teaching, but a very profound teaching. But again, you probably all know this. So, stabilizing the restless mind. That's what we're here for. Practicing mindfulness and calm abiding. That's what we've been doing a lot of, and we will continue doing it. As I've said many times in the course of retreat, you know, having this meditative quality, this mindfulness quality to your mind is incredibly helpful and stabilizing. And yet, and we've talked about a little bit, and I know Tammy asked about it yesterday. Mindfulness and concentration cannot do it by itself. Right? We have to look deeply into what agitates my mind. Right? You know, why don't I have a calm mind? Now again, as we've said, it could be because I've never learned these ways of mindfulness and concentration and how to calm the mind. But again, you see, calming the mind, and this is, you know, at the heart of the Buddhist meditative tradition, which says calm abiding will not liberate us. Calm abiding will just calm things down. But how come I have to calm myself down? You see? I mean, if I wasn't agitated, I wouldn't have to calm myself, would I? So, we have to look to see also at this now that we are calming and we are clearer and we can look more more directly into our minds to see what's going on. The obvious question is, what keeps me riled up? What keeps me agitated? You know, what's stressing me? Whatever you want to, you know, whatever terminology, you know, what's afflicting me? What's getting me upset? What's getting me angry? What's getting me resentful? What's getting me hurt? What's getting me scared? What's getting me sad? Despairing? What's roiling the waves? What are these winds that are blowing through my mind that disturb me? So that I have to what? Give up 4 precious days of my life to come to a retreat. Uncalming the mind, you know. Right? I mean, we could be in Vegas having a good time, right? You know, instead, here we are. All because we have an agitated mind. Now, again, it's not like the people in Vegas don't have agitated minds. Our problem is we have an agitated mind and we know it, you see. In a certain way, ignorance is bliss, right? Just go about your life. But unfortunately, we have a little self-awareness, a little knowledge that makes us look a little more deeply into things. That acknowledge that somehow having the agitated, stressed out, whatever we want to call it, mind, is not a healthy mind. So, please ask yourself the question, what robs my mind of its calmness? What robs my mind of its peacefulness? What stirs and agitates my mind? Where is it coming from? What's causing it? So this deep looking is essential because the manifestation of the problem may be over here, but the cause may be over here. And if we're always just trying to tamp it down over here without ever dealing with the primary causes, it is an endless process. So that is why in the Buddhist meditative tradition, insight, looking deeply, is kind of part two. Part one is the mindfulness and concentration. Part one, I mean, and part two is this deeper looking, which again, you know, as those who've been around know, I do a lot of that on other retreats. But I want to look, just do it specifically in terms of this retreat on calm abiding. Because I think in the description I said, you know, many of us have this restless mind, this unquiet mind that is not calm, and that often has afflictions in it. Why is that? Does anybody have just a little one-sentence guess? Why? I mean, everybody has it, so you should all be experts. We should all be experts. Why don't I have a calm? I mean, why do I got to come to a retreat? What? Susan?
Beliefs I have about the way things are supposed to be.
Okay. So Susan said, you know, beliefs about, you know, that I know how things should be. And when things aren't the way I think it should be, then what? Your mind gets disturbed. Good. Anybody else want to take a stab at why we don't have calm, peaceful minds?
Self at war with reality.
Self at war. Self is, yeah. Which is sort of what Susan was saying in another way. But yeah, exactly. The self is always... The ego, the I, me, my, is always taking an opposition to what's ever going on. And in that opposition creates lots of static. And that static, we have lots of names for it, but that's really what's going on. Yes, somebody else. Yes. Fear. We're afraid. Mm-hmm. What are we afraid of, Tammy? Wrong answer. Are you afraid of going to lunch today?
Just afraid it won't work out.
Afraid of losing what we have, perhaps. Or not getting what we want. Yeah, that's very disturbing for many people. You're absolutely right. Yes, Chris. Yeah, but how come? What's scattering us? You see, why? What? See, I mean, it's not like we have a scattered mind. Scattered mind means what? Yeah, well, it's distracted. But if you think about it, what's it distracted by? I mean, it's what's it distracted by? What? Yeah, thoughts, but, you know, a lot of our distraction, if you watch your thoughts, a lot of it is we are distracted, or we're thinking about pleasurable things that we'd like to have happen or have had happen that we like going over, or, you know, fear, you know, we're thinking about unpleasurable things that may happen or might happen, and so... Yeah, this whole kind of pleasure, I mean, the mind goes toward pleasure and sort of goes away from pain, but it's concerned about it. It's very concerned about it, right? I hope lunch is really good today. You see? See, that's the mind going to pleasure. Or, gee, that breakfast was really lousy, you know. Oh, that's the mind, you see. Why is the mind moving around all the time? See, what's scattering it? And when we look, we see there are some themes here. It's not just a random, you know, the monkey mind is looking at things. The monkey likes to look at things. It gets interested in things. you know, what is it that's always, you know, why aren't we interested in virtue? Why aren't we interested in you know, all kinds of wholesome things? Why is the mind so clingy to things that don't bring it much solidity or joy? It's something we need to ask ourselves. Any other ideas about why we... Yes. Yes, Carolyn. Well, it could be, but again, if it's always ready, I would say it's probably tied in with what Tammy was saying, that there's an anxiety that somehow you have to be ready. So you have to be ready. Got to get it right. Right? Got to get it perfect. Heaven forbid that I shouldn't be ready, not look good, not have the right answer. You know what I mean? It's, if you think about it, what's really going on? Yes. That could be, yeah. So he's saying maybe there's another issue on the other side, which is we have lost our capacity to be comfortable with quiet or silence or nothing going on. Sort of a stimulant, kind of addictive spiral that our minds have gotten into, that when all of a sudden we're not getting our fix, we're not getting our substance, it doesn't feel good or it feels unpleasant. Yeah, I think that's a certainly a modern age one that I think, you know, I think traditional peoples didn't have, because they lived in silence. They lived with lots of space and time, right? They were agriculturists. They spent their days basically doing nothing, right? Just following the cattle around or working in the fields or being in their little shops, you know, just doing the same thing day after day. I mean, it was a very... You know, there was a lot of silence, just normally, in life. Yeah, and when we... Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So that's... So Elena's going, you know, right to the heart of things and saying, well, the key piece, perhaps, is that we are ignorant. Ignorant of what? What? Ignorant of the way things are. Right? Yeah, so you know, that's a good way to start. Yeah, so obviously Buddhism has a lot to say about everything that has been said here. It has teachings that are very specific to all these various mind states and antidotes to all the various mind states, specific ones that people talked about. But it also has teachings like drive all blames into one, the one being self. And it does have very deep teachings that point that everything that arises is arising in the mind. So why are we always looking outside ourselves? You see. So, Tammy, what if you did lose everything? Right? Let's take your worst fear. You know what I mean? Like, let's go just put it all together. You know, we lost everything, right? You lost your job, you lost your house, right? I mean, this is like worst case scenario. You know, may it not happen, okay? But see, there's one thing when you think about it that way, you're just creating this kind of disaster scenario in your mind, of which it just unfolds like a disaster. But we often leave out other parts which have the ability to stabilize us, right? So if I said, let's say you lost everything. Now, I mean, do you have any family or friends? If you lost everything. You know, would people be there for you? No. I'm saying, would they be there for you? I mean, are you alone? Well, all right, but I'm not. All right, but wow, you are. Wow, you really. Yeah, I can. Yeah, I'm saying. Just relax. Right, there you go. But see, I would get rid of that disaster plan and replace it with confidence and trust. You see, if you know that if that ever happened, you know, when just coming through hurricane season, we see it's living in Florida, it is possible, isn't it? You know, but to know that whatever happens, you will be there, right? And if there's a remedy, you will find it, right? And if there's no remedy and you just got to deal with it, you'll deal with it. You see? And when you know that within yourself, then you don't need to always be planning, because I think our planning has a lot to do with our lack of confidence and trust. Confidence and trust in ourselves, in our own capacities, and confidence and trust that we are not alone. Right? Now, you know, that's why it's so important to have connections. So we know we're not alone. Right? And if that situation happened, you know, there are other people who will be there with you, for you, with you. And when you have that trust and confidence, you don't have to plan anymore. I mean, I'm not saying no planning. I mean, certainly in life there is some planning. But I mean, that kind of, and that worry, it's like, yeah, everything will, you know. You know, that's why, again, these practices that I just talked about, you know, our ability not to resist life, right, is so helpful. Because it means, yeah, whatever happens, I will respond to it, whatever it is, right? And hopefully, if my mind is clear and stable, I'll respond to it in a good way, in a wholesome way, you know, not from fear, not from anger, not from despair, all that are destructive kind of emotionality. But I'll deal with it, you know, in a rational way, in a kind way, in a loving way, you know. Oh, you see, it's a very different, you know, or at the very least, you know, there may be other people that I can help in that situation too. Oftentimes we it gets very narrow, just down to me, survival. But you realize, oh, there are probably other people maybe in that same situation. Maybe I can be of help to them. Yes. So this is important. You know, and I would certainly say what some of you are saying about you know, what agitates the mind so much is our inability to accept what is. To accept people as they are, situations as they are, the world as it is. See, that's kind of a solution. It's kind of a one-size-fits-all solution. It can work with very tiny things, and it can work with big things. But it prevents us from going down the road of afflictive emotions. Fear, anger, despair, right? It's very simple. And when we watch our mind as it clings, when we watch our mind attaching, right? So if you watch your mind, as many of you have been doing these last few days, and you watch the thoughts arising and passing, what percentage of those thoughts or mind, or let's say thoughts, are really meaningful ones that you really want to think are, you know, really significant and you really want to cultivate? I mean, just on a scale from 1% to 100%, what percent of those thoughts that pass through your mind have any kind of, you know, significance? Less than 1%. All right. I won't argue with you, but yeah. And so when we look at, you know, the rest of it, and then, well, let me just say, then what percent of it is afflictive? What? No, well, probably not 99. I mean, what percent of it is afflictive? Where they're the kind of thoughts that actually cause you some suffering, that bring up anger or fear or sadness, or, you know, jealousy or impatience. I mean, what percent is that, do you think?
I think it depends on where you are.
Yeah, yeah, but just generally. Mm-hmm. 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 Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah, yeah. But I'm just saying on a kind of random basis, like, you know, just going through your day or just going through retreat without anything of significance, just on its own, what percent do you think arose that has sort of an afflictive or negative twist to it? What? 20%. 10%. 1%. All right. Well, let's see how interesting that is. So what does that tell us when we step back and we look at what's arising and passing in our mind? It sounds as if 80% of it is sort of kind of useless. It really doesn't have any significance at all, does it? Right? And 20% of it is downright afflictive. So, what do? We look at our mind, we take an inventory, and you go 80% meaningless, 20% afflictive. What do now? Well, I don't know. I mean, I think we need to. I'm just saying, it's just interesting. If we actually objectively look at the kind of thoughts we've had that are passing through our mind, how many of them, you know, that our mind is continually filled with compassionate thoughts or thoughts of understanding, thoughts of patience? I mean, how many would say, yeah, that's really the state of my mind? Yes? Yeah, so what Angie's saying is very meaningful. She's saying in a certain way, we can say, oh, that 80, 90%, whatever, or 99%, you know, whatever it is, that's kind of meaningless or just not of much point. It's taking up space in which something much more meaningful could be occurring. And if you add that to the space we give to afflictive mind states, then we can kind of understand why we have the mind that we have and why we feel the way we do. Well, afflictive state has meaning in Buddhist psychology in relationship to wholesome states. Wholesome states basically feel good. When you have a wholesome state, when you're feeling love, when you're feeling compassion, when you're feeling patience, when you're happy, they feel good. You know what I mean? It's a human experience. We know that. I mean, you know, if I said to you, when you're angry, when you're resentful, when you're scared, you know, when you're down, how do you feel? Do you feel good? How's it feel? And you'd say what? No. It's afflictive. It afflicts our well-being. So Buddhist psychology has, you know, it doesn't, it's not just a category of problems and issues like Western psychology. Buddhist psychology primarily has a psychology of well-being and healthy mental states, but also is very clear about there are unhealthy mental states that rob us of our mental well-being, our emotional well-being, right? And so I think that's what Angie was just referring to when it says, yeah. It's, again, it sort of comes back to, you know, the way we live our life, you know, the activities of our life. If we are spending most of our life doing activities that either are neutral, sort of meaningless, or they're not productive of anything positive, or we're doing things that are actually producing things that are afflictive or negative, well, no wonder we feel the way we do. Yeah, it can be lots of different experiences. But right, but when you say off balance, what's not in balance?
Well, positive things, just too much of this
or too much happiness?
Yeah.
Really? Is that what you suffer from?
Actually, I have a lot of happiness.
Well, good. Yeah, that's kind of that self-awareness. But again, and this again comes down to, you know, the Buddhist psychology and attachment aversion and the worldly winds, I mean, things that we get onto in other intensives, retreats. You know, even like Tammy was saying, even our worldly successes, right? The job, the house, you know what I mean, all these things, you know. And even worldly happinesses, right? Our life is good now, we might say. Yeah, everything's come together, healthy, people, families, you know, right now there's no... But all that is what? Temporary, transient, impermanent. It could all be taken away in a moment. So that is why in Buddhism we don't want our happiness... You know, many people may say, "Yeah, I'm really in a good..." You know, people say, I'm really in a good state these days. Yeah, my mind is pretty calm. But usually that means because everything's going my way now. You see, it's like that's a worldly calmness. You know, everything's going my way. Everything's sort of, yeah. So I don't have to be agitated. You see, like I don't have to be agitated. But that is a very superficial calmness. There's no depth to it because it can easily disappear. When things change, when life change, when situations change. So that kind of calmness, well, you know, I would say if you have that, wonderful. You know, I mean, good for you, you know, that your life is momentarily that way or for a long time. But, you know, again, these are, you know, these various teachings of Buddhism all kind of come together where these teachings of impermanence, sickness, old age, and death, you know, even if everything's good, right? I mean, you live in Naples, you know, when I used to be a therapist in Naples, you know, I used to see a lot of depressed, very successful people. You know why? No, it wasn't, because can you believe it? After working hard their whole life and making lots of money and getting the condo or the house in Naples and coming down and they had their whole life ahead of them, can you believe it? They got sick. Or they got old. You know, they can't swing the golf club. I mean, these, you know what I mean? Like, you know what I mean? Or they had stomach issues, so they couldn't go out to dinner every night. Okay, you know, can you? So even, you know, so even there, you can see, they forgot about impermanence. Or they forgot that their spouse got sick and they needed to be taken. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, that wasn't in the plan. See, that wasn't in the master plan. Does that make sense? So, you know. No, it's the hearing thing. Can you help him? Oh. What? Uh-huh. Can anybody help Tony? Oh, no. Well, maybe. Yeah. I mean, it's okay, but. Okay. See? There it is. Something happens, it's a little unpleasant, but there's a remedy. We're happy. The remedy did it. If there wasn't a remedy, we would have to sort of live with it, wouldn't we? That's okay. So, you know, understanding the nature of impermanence is very important, because it allows us to understand, you know, like if like Tammy was saying, if my stability and therefore my happiness, right, and security and feeling of well-being is predicated on everything staying the same, right? Can you see what a setup that is for problems, for agitation, for emotional affliction? Because that is not the nature of reality. The nature of reality is everything changes. Causes and conditions. Right? So do we want to live, do we want to have a mindset? Do we want to have a philosophy of life? Do we want to have a way of being in life that is in accord with reality, that allows us to live at peace and harmony and calmness in reality as it is? Or do we not? You know, and that's just a question we all have to answer. The same way, you know, many people lose their calmness because they're not the way they want themselves to be, right? Forget about the world. I'm not the person I think I should be. You know, people do meditation and they go, and they get discouraged or they get angry or frustrated. Why? Because I don't have the mind I think I should have. It's the same craziness. Things are what they are. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, right. Gentleman back there, he took his inventory. He said, 99% of what passes through my mind is just junk food. All right. Good assessment. Starting from now on, what do you want to do? You see, I mean, that's where we put our energy. Not in discouragement, not in frustration, not in despair, not in anything. It's like not worth it, right? We note it, we see it, we have a moment of insight, and then we take that. Yes, Ned. I mean, there it is. I mean, what do you want? Continuing with catastrophic thinking, Ned says, "Yeah, like not only am I going to lose everything and I'm going to die, but yeah, that is possible for everyone and everything, including right now the planet. I mean, there are many people, you know, scientists, other people are talking about the planet." Right? As we know it, life as we know it, right? No, you know, may not go on and on because of human beings' foolishness, whatever. Yeah. So, yeah, at the most existential level, getting right to the depth of our existence, yeah, we live with that possibility. Now, why does it scare us? You see. Yeah. So if that's a fact, you see, if that's a fact, that in reality that's a possibility. I mean, is it a possibility, all my children and grandchildren, everybody could get in a car wreck together and die? Is that a possibility in the realm of possibility? Well, I have to accept that is a possibility. Is that not? If it happens, you know, we don't want it to happen, obviously. But if it happens, what do I do at that moment? This is reality. This is what's happened. You know, do I go down the road of it shouldn't happen? But it did happen. Could I go down the road of, you know, why do things like this happen? But I understand they happen according to causes and conditions in this impermanent world. Right. Do I get angry because it happened to me? See, oftentimes we get angry because, we read every day about people dying in car accidents all over the world, and we just read it as a fact. But when it happens to me, it's like, oh no, this shouldn't happen to me. Why not? If it could happen to anybody else, why shouldn't it happen to me? If it could happen to somebody else's child, why shouldn't it happen to my child? I mean, that's not there's no emotion in that. There's no personal in that, which of course we have. I'm just setting that aside. But in the realm of reality, yes, it's in that. I mean, this is the power of Buddhism, that it says in this world of impermanence, where really we don't know anything to be stable or secure over any period of time, how can I live in calmness? How can I dwell in tranquility? Right? Most people would go, impossible. And yet it's not. If one has the correct understanding and view, which is what I was talking about, as well as has a meditative practice that allows one to touch within oneself the place of calmness and stability, right? You know, then we have the possibility of dealing with the most horrendous situations. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh, he would say, you know, many of you know, he would say, you know, he would talk about, the boat people, you know, and probably many of you know this. And, you know, when they were, the period, in the 70s, I think it was, when the many Vietnamese were fleeing Vietnam and crossing the seas, right? And, a lot of their boats were not very seaworthy, storms and all kinds of problems in the high seas, pirates, they were often attack people, and I mean, all kinds of difficult thing. And then he would say, when you're in the boat with all these people, and, you know, the winds are blowing and all kinds of, and everybody's getting scared, he said, who's going to be that one person to stay stable, to stay grounded? Not just for yourself, but for them. When everybody, you know, what's that? When everybody else is losing their head around you, you know, it's like, you know, who's going to be that one? You know, who's going to be that one in the face of impermanence, sickness, old age, and death, change, and all this? Who's going to stay stable, solid, and project fearlessness? The Buddha has a mudra of fearlessness. Do not be afraid. Now, how can he say that when there's so much, in a certain sense, to be afraid of? Because he knows intrinsically there's nothing to be afraid of. We're all going to die. Right, Ned? We're all going to die. You're going to die. I'm going to die. My children are going to die. My grandchildren are going to die. Everybody's going to die. Right? Everybody in this room is going to die. Anybody think they're not going to die? Right? Anybody think that everybody they love is not going to die? I mean, I don't want to be brutal here, but I mean, this is just a fact. And that we intellectually know it. Isn't that true? You know, the only thing we don't know is what? When it's going to happen. I mean, that's the truth. We don't know. Do we wish a long, good life for everyone? Of course we do. That is our wish. But at the same time we wish it, we know we don't know. So the key is, how do you live in this world knowing it's broken and yet, you know, live at peace? And that's what the practice, the study and the conceptual philosophical practice, but most importantly, the realization that comes through the practice of meditation, you actually experience within your own self your non-self spacious awareness. that has no, that is not bound by birth and death, simply said. It is what is. And so even to have a glimpse of that, even in these 4 days, just for, even if you're a beginner and have touched, you know, your ability to have a calm, clear mind, that's kind of an entranceway. I mean, that's your mind. That's the host. The host stays. This body, it's a guest. The body's not the host, right? Everybody here has a birth certificate. You know what that signifies? What?
Yes.
Well, that's coming. But that was well pointed out. But everybody here has a birth certificate. That means at some point you appeared in this physical body, right? And somebody certified that. In case anybody would ever wonder where you came from, you could always hold up your birth certificate to prove I was born to these people. Right? And at the end, we'll get a death certificate. So our bodies are just guests in this world. Right? We come and we leave. Right? We're guests in this world. In the physical world, we are just guests. So that is why, you know, not putting all our eggs in the basket of our body and its needs and its wants, you know, is an intelligent understanding. You know, this goes back to the Buddha, right? You know, remember the Buddha? You know, you've heard me tell the life of the Buddha. The Buddha had a good life. He had security, he had good friends. In the social scale of his little principality there in northern India, he was at the top, you know, I mean, it was all good, right? But when he realized that none of it was permanent, right? His physical well-being, he was young, he was in his 20s, he felt very energetic, very athletic, enjoyed a lot of sensual enjoyments, and he realized none of it is permanent. I'm going to die, and I can't take any of it with me. It's all meaningless. All his achievements, all his friends, all his loved ones. When he realized, when he saw a dead person and realized, oh my God, that's how I'm going to end up. And everything that I've put all my energy in over here, none of it is going with me. I mean, that stopped him in his tracks. You know, that's really kind of interesting, isn't it? When you think about how much energy we put into kind of getting ourselves comfortable in the world, getting the things of the world, right? Again, which as lay people we have to do to some degree, but you realize for many people that's what it's all about, right? And yet at the end, whether you're the richest person in the world, the most powerful person in the world, whether you're the most powerless or poorest person in the world, it all comes to an end. Right? Exit stage left. Stage left. Right? There it is. And that's just the truth. That's just a fact. That's not good or bad. It's not theology. It's not Buddhism. It's just reality. It's science, let's call it. And yet here we are, right? Here we are in the sinking ship, we might say, just to keep it going. Okay? Here we are in the sinking ship, right? Even as we talk, it's leaking. If we, you know, we're all aging, right? Even as we talk, if we look down, we can see. beginning to take on some water here. How do you want to live? See, that's the question. How do you want to live? How do you in this life of impermanence with nothing really to rely on, nothing really totally stable, how do you create meaning and purpose, goodness? Right? Isn't that our challenge? So that's, what any valid spiritual path, Buddhism is just the one I know. I hope there are many valid spiritual paths they give people. But this is what it has to answer to people. Show them a way. Wow, getting kind of heavy duty over here. Yeah, how can we laugh in the face of this? Right? But yet we do, don't we? Right? We laugh, we love, we enjoy what's there to be enjoyed. That is the paradox of all this. Continuing with Shanti Deva. For those who have no introspection, though they hear the teachings, ponder them, or meditate, like water seeping from a leaking jar, their learning will not settle in their memories. So now we're back to this chapter on vigilant introspection, mindfulness, the gatekeeper. Remember? So we're back to this. And we always have to come back to this because this is where the answer is. So for many people, even though they read the teachings, hear the teaching, think about them, they do some meditation, like water seeping from a leaking jar, whatever they're learning through their study and practice is seeping away. It doesn't settle into memory because there's no gatekeeper. Right? There's nobody vigilant to make sure that it stays in. Right? There's nobody remembering. Remember? If we're just learning but forgetting what we've learned, then there's really no learning, is there? So we have to remember. Many are endowed with joyful diligence. They're learned also and imbued with faith. But through the fault of lacking introspection, they will not escape the stain of sin and downfall. Again, a little fire and brimstone. So even in Buddhism, there is that tradition. Some sentient beings, they need it. If they don't know, they're going to fall into the dark as hell and fry forever. They'll just be up there. Just causing all kinds of problems to sentient beings. So sometimes a little fire and brimstone is good for certain people. So we can't knock it. Lack of introspection is a thief. It slinks behind when mindfulness abates. And all the merit we have gathered in, it steals. And down we go. So, again, if our practice is episodic, if our mindfulness practice is episodic, if our meditation practice is episodic, if our commitment to living, whatever noble way we want to live, is episodic, if there isn't mindfulness, if there isn't some part of us that is vigilant and remembering what we're doing throughout our day, or at least enough during the day that we remember it, it will, like a thief, lack of introspection is a thief. It steals away all our good intentions, all our virtues, all our high aspirations. And everybody here has them. You wouldn't be here if you didn't have them. And you often wonder, well, why, if I have them really in my heart, if I really think about my life and what's meaningful to me and how I want to live, why don't I follow through? Right? As he said, it's not because you're not endowed with joyful diligence. It's not as if you don't have confidence or faith, and you know, it's not as if you haven't studied and pondered the teaching. But without mindfulness, without the gatekeeper, without this vigilance, right, this watchfulness, it will often seep away. Therefore, from the gateway of my mindfulness shall not have leave to stray. And if it wanders, it shall be recalled. Now again, that recalling, there are many different ways to recall ourselves. Right? Some it's simply, recalling, you know, that I'm distracted. Simple as that. I let it go, I come back. Very simple recalling. For some, it may have to be a little more elaborate. Sort of what we were talking about earlier. Thinking about all the benefits that come from the practice. From staying vigilant. From cultivating mindfulness. From cultivating calmness. From cultivating concentration. You know, we have to remind ourselves, right? Sometimes it has to be a little on the aversive side. We remind ourselves, you know, if I don't have any control over my mind or mind states, if I don't know how to let go of a mind state, positive or negative, then I'm still, you know, at the mercy of all these afflictive mind states that just arise in my mind. So this capacity of being aware and letting go is a mind capacity that even though you may be doing it over here with just kind of the random unfolding of thoughts and stories in your mind, of which people have said, you know, are mostly just meaningless. But the thing is, as somebody said, 10 or 20% of the ones that are going to come up are going to be afflictive. And they often come up with a lot of juice. And they, when they grab us, they stay around for a long time. So if we don't have mind, if we haven't developed with all these kind of benign, sort of meaningless or little kinds of thoughts, or even the pleasurable ones, how to see, not judge it good or, you know, but just see it and let it go, no matter what it is. That's our practice. When we're practicing samatha, good, bad, indifferent, all thoughts, all mind states, all stories are treated the same. We see them just as they are, and we let them go because our focus is to be aware of whatever the object of our meditation is. That skill, well, then you will have, you know, no matter what arises in your mind. But if you haven't developed it, you know, you'll never, in the face of your afflictive mind states, be able to let them go in this way because they're strong. Anybody understand what, you know? They're strong. And everybody has their own particular one or ones that are strong. They just come into the mind just very spontaneously, and all of a sudden they just flood it. And if you're not mindful and if you don't have any strength to see, it's, you know, to name it, understand it's an afflictive mind state, and just let it be. Don't give it any juice, don't grab onto it. You know, that takes a certain kind of mind strength. Certain kind of understanding. Is that clear? And it comes from practice. It doesn't come from just reading the book. Therefore, from the gateway of my mind, my mindfulness shall not have leave to stray. And if it wanders, it shall be recalled. And then he says, through fear, and by counsels of their abbots, he's obviously thinking about people who are monks, and staying ever in their teacher's company, in those endowed with fortune and devotion, mindfulness is cultivated easily. It's interesting. So what is he saying? So again, some of us again may not be comfortable, but Shantideva, as I said earlier, has a little bit of hell, fire, and brimstone in him, and he's certainly not averse to trying to scare the hell out of people to get them to practice. So if he was alive today, he might be Pentecostal or something. I'm not sure. he's sort of an old timer there. But again, it's sort of whatever works, you see. You know, whatever motivates you. And for some people, being afraid of falling back into painful mind states, afflictive mind states, you know, that maybe you've lived in the past, you know, not wanting to go back there and recalling them and going, you know, having a kind of a genuine fear of that, and that if that motivates you to practice and to put into practice what you know, he's saying through fear, and now on the positive side, through counsels of the abbots, right? So this is sort of saying, you know, by being in the environment of healthy people, wholesome people, people who support you and nourish you with wisdom and compassion, right? And staying ever in their teacher's company again, which is just, I mean, when we think about teachers, or we think about Sangha, we think about Dharma friends, right? You know, we think about community. I mean, that's what he's saying. It is much easier when we have that this kind of support, you know, to cultivate this meditative path, then we don't have any of that. And these are the last two lines of this chapter. The last two verses say, and it sort of sums it all up, examining again and yet again the state and actions of your body-mind, this alone defines in brief the maintenance of watchful introspection. Okay, so, you know, in the last couple of days we've begun to talk about this. When the mind settles, when the mind is clear, clearer, more settled, right, we want to watch and examine the mind. We want to place a gatekeeper. So whatever practice we're doing, whether we're doing meditative practice, whether we're doing walking practice, whether we're doing eating practice, whether we're doing going to the bathroom practice, whatever our practice is of being mindful and present, there's a part of our mind that is just watchful. You know, it's just like a piece of our mind. It's just kind of aware of the mind itself. And it's aware of what's arising within it. It's aware of its mind state. Okay, it's aware of its mindfulness. And it's just making adjustments as needed. Okay, it doesn't have to be, you know, tense or tight or very rigid, you know, like it's a, you know, somebody with a stick over you. But there's just a part of our mind that's very aware, self-aware. Examining again and yet again the state and actions of your body-mind, this alone defines in brief the maintenance of watchful introspection. But all this must be acted out in truth, for what is gained by mouthing syllables? What invalid was ever helped by merely reading in the doctor's treatises? Not very, you know, meaningful. I mean, we might say, you know, what invalid was ever helped by just reading the doctor's prescription? No, we need to take the prescription to the pharmacy, get the medicine. But again, we might say, what invalid was ever helped by reading the doctor's treatises, going to the pharmacy, getting the medicine, and then keeping it on your shelf? Right? The medicine has to be taken. And that's, for many of us, where we, and this is what he's saying again, he said earlier, we say, well, you know, I've been practicing, I've been studying, I've been reading, I've been doing all this stuff, coming to Sangha. You know, how come I still have afflictive emotions? How come I still don't have a peaceful mind, right? I thought, right? Isn't that what we say? You know, what's wrong? Well, he's saying, you know, we haven't taken the medicine yet. The medicine is the practice. The medicine is putting the teachings into practice the way we've been talking about this morning. They have to become real. You know, we can mouth the words of the five reflections. We do that every morning, right? You've done that every morning here, right? Ned, how many times have you recited the five reflections and contemplated them? What? Hundreds. And yet, do you really accept it? Deep. Have you realized the meaning of those words? And that's what he's saying. You know, we have to take the medicine, even if it's a bitter medicine. Impermanence is a bitter medicine, isn't it? Death is a bitter medicine. I mean, it's not what we would like, right? But it is the nature of things. So, you know, all medicines will make us healthy if it's a good medicine. So some medicines are sweet. Some medicines are a little bitter. Chinese medicine, they say the more bitter, the better, stronger. So any questions? Any questions before we end? Everybody clear how to practice? Yeah, I think it's just a matter of practicing and reflect. You know, if there are things that were said today that have meaning to you, or you want to really understand them more deeply, you know, you can do your own reflection, your own meditation on, so they become real to you. Digestion. Good. So we'll stop now.